Welcome to the Community Oncology Journal podcast for March 2013. I'm Dr. David Henry. This issue brings us interesting updates on the newly approved T-DMI molecule for HER2-positive breast cancer patients, followed by an insert on how I treat HER2-positive breast cancer patients by one of our editors. The U.S. Oncology Network reviewed its treatment patterns for HER2-positive, hormone receptor-positive postmenopausal women and reported their findings in this month's issue. Plasmablastic lymphoma is a rare subtype of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. We have a case report of it presenting in the ileum with a discussion of prognosis and therapy. A second case report tells us about methotrexate-induced erythema multiforme, which is actually in the FDA black box warning about methotrexate, but rarely seen. We have two articles on data-driven changes and pathways in physician practices. We finished this month with a charming article by a first-year fellow who writes about being a first-year mother and a first-year fellow at the same time. So let's begin. T-DM1 adds to the armamentarium for targeting advanced HER2-positive breast cancer by Dr. Maria Cristina Figueroa-Mahalais and Dr. Vered Stearns from the Kimmel Comprehensive Cancer Center, Johns Hopkins, Baltimore. The FDA approved T-DM1, also known as trastuzumab emtansine, as a single agent for patients with HER2-positive advanced breast cancer who have previously received trastuzumab and a taxane. This novel agent binds the trastuzumab molecule tightly linked to a drug conjugate of emtansine, or DM1, which targets tubulin and suppresses microtubule dynamics. Approval was based on the Amelia Phase 3 trial of 991 patients with advanced HER2-positive breast cancer who had previously received both trastuzumab and a taxane. The patients were randomized to receive 3.6 mg per kilogram IV of T-DM1 every 21 days, or the combination of capecitabine at 1,000 mg per meter squared every 12 hours for 14 days out of every 21 days, and the oral daily lapatinib 1250 mg per day until progression or unmanageable toxicity. Progression-free survival was significantly better at 9.6 versus 6.4 months in the T-DM1 arm, and even more impressive was the overall median survival of 30.9 months versus 25.1, favoring T-DM1. Toxicities were manageable, with the most common grade 3-4 adverse event being thrombocytopenia and elevated liver function in under 5% of patients. Of course, heart toxicity was still tracked and watched for because of the trastuzumab-based molecule and was not any different from trastuzumab itself. An ongoing phase 3 trial named Marianne will evaluate HER2 blockade using T-DM1 plus pertuzumab versus T-DM1 plus placebo in first-line HER2 metastatic cancer patients compared with trastuzumab and a taxane. Studies are also underway in the adjuvant and neoadjuvant settings. The authors further describe how they now treat HER2-positive advanced breast cancer given the agents available to us. They recommend T-DM1 be the second-line treatment choice following trastuzumab, and then lapatinib-based therapy would be the third-line choice. But of course, you may also want to use the newly approved pertuzumab with trastuzumab in the first-line setting. Next, treatment patterns in HER2-positive, hormone-positive postmenopausal women with metastatic breast cancer initiating first-line treatment in a community oncology setting in the U.S. by Dr. Pooza Sharma and colleagues from the U.S. Oncology Network, Houston, Texas. Electronic medical records for postmenopausal HER2 hormone-positive patients with newly diagnosed metastatic breast cancer were reviewed from 2007 to 2010. 347 such patients were identified, of whom 258, or 74%, did not have evidence of visceral metastases. Chemotherapy plus targeted hormone therapy was the most frequently used treatment strategy. Trastuzumab was the most frequently used HER2 targeted agent, followed by lapatinib. Paclitaxel and letrozole were the most often used chemotherapy and endocrine therapies, respectively. Over time, trastuzumab use decreased while lapatinib use increased. Interestingly, a significant portion of patients received no chemotherapy in the first-line setting at all, rather hormone and HER2 therapies instead. plasmablastic lymphoma in the ileum by Dr. Ahmed Matak from Firelands Regional Medical Center, Sandusky, Ohio. Plasmablastic lymphoma, a subtype of aggressive non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, is quite unusual, and when it presents, usually occurs in patients 35 to 55 years old with a male predominance and immune suppression, such as in HIV patients. The patient reported here was immunosuppressed, was not immunosuppressed, and his mass presented in the ileum with multiple masses causing small bowel obstruction. Therapy and management are discussed in this nice case report and review. Methotrexate-induced erythema multiforme by Dr. Miranda Kim and colleagues from the Pennsylvania Hospital in Philadelphia. Methotrexate is a drug commonly used to treat a range of diseases, including inflammatory conditions and malignancies. Of course, it is not a benign drug and can have serious toxicities, and a case report here of methotrexate-induced erythema multiforme is presented. Interestingly, methotrexate has a black box warning for erythema multiforme, but the authors only found three previously published cases in the literature. Data-driven changes, pathways, and physician buy-in by Sherry Bouchert. More and more comprehensive cancer care is being delivered in the community setting. This article discusses the team effort in a solo practice with the inclusion of pathways and physician involvement in a larger practice setting. The common theme being collaboration and the use of pathways. There follows an article entitled, Clinical Pathways, Are We There Yet? By Dr. Marcus Neubauer and colleagues from the U.S. Oncology Network. Once again, best cancer care demands the inclusion of pathways. These pathways have to be integrated into information technology medical records, most commonly now the electronic medical record. This article discusses the 80% rule, which aims for at least 80% compliance with a pathway as the goal is an indicator of outstanding compliance. The next steps, of course, would be to follow on with the inclusion of national approved guidelines like the NCCN or American Society of Hematology or American Society of Clinical Oncology as often as possible. Finally, we conclude this month's issue with a charming article by Dr. Marlena Orloff from Jefferson University Hospital in Philadelphia entitled On Being a First-Year Fellow and a First-Year Mother. Dr. Orloff added to the challenge of being a first-year fellow by having fraternal twins, a boy and a girl. Her heartwarming tale of how to be the best doctor, learning her new specialty of hematology-oncology, yet also be the best first-year mom, will fascinate you and is really heartwarming. The good news is she did both superbly. And that concludes this month's issue of the Community Oncology Journal podcast for the March 2013 issue. We welcome your comments and suggestions, so please visit us at our website, communityoncology.net, where you can also search archived articles, and thanks for listening.